It's arguably the world's biggest and most expensive scientific experiment. I mean, the moon landings were probably bigger and more expensive, but the Large Hadron Collider, the LHC, has cost $10 billion US. It's near Geneva, and a lot of people are hoping that, for one thing, it's going to fill a vital hole in our physical knowledge. It's going to find, hopers say, a fundamental subatomic particle called the Higgs boson. The LHC is a ring with a circumference of 27 kilometres. It's 100 metres underground. Dr. Brian Cox is a particle physicist at the University of Manchester who has been contributing to the LHC project, commuting between Manchester and Geneva. And I asked Dr. Cox if, on the day, there's a big switch that somebody's going to throw.
Everybody asked that, and the guys in the control room said that they're thinking of installing a big red button just for the press. But actually, it's a return key. You know, it's all computer controlled, as you can imagine. So it's just a case of running the right computer program, and the particles go in. But I suspect, actually, when I arrive down in the control room on Wednesday, there'll be a big red cartoon button that's been installed for television purposes.
I take it you're not worried about the last-minute challenge to the European Court for Human Rights by the people who fear that you're going to create a mini black hole that's going to tear the Earth apart.
Now, it's complete and utter nonsense.
Oh, it's all very well for you to say that.
Well, it is, because I'm a particle physicist. And
oh, yes, that's right.
The difference between me and everybody else in the scientific establishment and the couple of people who want to stop the thing is that we do know a little bit about particle physics. And I know that sounds a bit arrogant in a way, but I think there's a serious point, which is a wider problem, actually, that the internet allows people who don't know anything to have a very loud voice, and you only need one or two, and this is one or two people, to start spreading rumours, and they can take off. And I think it's a problem not only for particle physics, and that's not a serious problem because we just ignore them, but I mean, in Britain we had a problem with a child vaccine called the MMR vaccine, and again, one of these rumours went round that it could be dangerous, and thousands of people stopped inoculating their children against mumps and measles and rubella. And we've had a kind of rise in childhood deaths because people are not getting vaccinated and not vaccinating their babies. So I think it is actually a serious issue, and how you deal with it, I don't know, really.
Well, I mean, I suppose at the best level, it shows that people have an appetite for science. It may be wrong science, and it's up to you to write it, I guess.
Well, I'm not sure whether it's an appetite for science. There's also a fear of science and an acceptance of conspiracy theories and a feeling that somehow science is working against the people. And I think that's actually a serious problem, because it isn't. I mean, finding out how the universe works is actually essential for our ongoing survival and our quality of life. And if you do get into a mindset where you are suspicious of everything that's said about, you know, global warming or genetic engineering or whatever it is, and you don't really engage in a meaningful debate, then I think we're in for trouble as a society, actually. So it is a problem.
All right, tell me what your LHC is going to achieve when you press that red button, the metaphorical red button.
Well, on Wednesday, actually, all we're doing is trying to get one beam of particles to go around the machine for the first time, just to check that it works. But after that, in the coming months, we'll put another beam of particles in and we'll start colliding them together. And the idea is to go back to the conditions of the early universe. We're something like a billionth of a second after the universe began, which sounds like a very short space of time. Actually, there's a lot happened in that first billionth of a second. It's part of a quest that we've had for, let's say, 100 years. We've been on this journey to understand the building blocks of matter. And so what we're looking for is the simplest building blocks of everything, which is you and me and the stars that we see in the sky and planet Earth, and also to understand the forces that stick them together. So it's really the quest for the most basic knowledge about how the universe works.
In other words, at the Big Bang, there was no mass, and then afterwards there was mass, but where did the mass come from? Are you trying to find that out?
Oh, well, yeah, that's one of the big questions. So you're talking about this theoretical particle called the Higgs particle, which you hear a lot about. Sometimes it's called the God particle. Actually, it's not a very good name, but it was invented by a chap called Leon Lederman. Well, a chap, a Nobel Prize winning physicist who wanted to sell a book. And it's a very good title for a book. One of the areas where our knowledge breaks down is, as you said, the origin of mass in the universe. So why is stuff is the way that I'd like to say. You know, if you look at your hand, it's solid. The particles that make it up have got mass. And our current theories suggest that in the very early universe they didn't. And then as the universe expanded and cooled, something happened and mass kind of crystallized out in a sense. And we have some theories for what that may be. But the key thing is we know where to look for that mechanism. So our theories may be wrong. I mean, often we're not clever enough to second guess nature, but what we do know is where to look. So it's a very profound and a simple question, and it's where our knowledge stops at the moment. So that's one of the things we may find. There are many other ones, actually.
Such as?
Well, we found over the last, let's say, 10 years or so, by looking out into space, that there's a lot of stuff out there in the universe that doesn't shine. It's not the stuff that makes up stars and planets and indeed us. It seems to be something else, and we call it dark matter. And it seems, we just see it by its gravitational influence, and it seems that there's actually five times as much of that as there is the stuff that the common or garden stuff that we're made of. Now, we don't know what the nature of that is, but there are quite a few fairly popular theories in particle physics that suggest there should be another class of particles that we might find at the LHC, which may well be good candidates for this stuff, this dark matter that seems to essentially dominate the universe. So we may discover what most of the universe is made of, which would be also profound.
Is this what you've called neutrinos?
Yes, that's right. They're one candidate for this stuff, this dark matter. They're so-called supersymmetric particles. So it's kind of a theoretical construct at the moment, which has many nice properties for particle physicists. But it also does the job of providing a candidate for this dark matter stuff. It was very important, this stuff. One thing we think it did was seed the formation of galaxies in the very early universe. So without this stuff, it could well be the case that there wouldn't be stars and planets and galaxies, and we wouldn't exist. So it's kind of it could be very fundamental in understanding how we got to be here.
So dark matter has a gravitational effect, right?
Yeah.
And so that's why we think it's there, because we've worked out that it has there wouldn't be that gravitational effect if something wasn't there.
Yeah, it's really simple, actually. You just look at... it is really simple. You just look at galaxies spinning around. So that's all we do. We look at galaxies that we can see in the sky, and they spin around. And they spin around too fast. So basically, if there wasn't a lot more stuff holding the galaxy together, a lot more gravity than we see, then the things wouldn't spin around that fast. So they just fly apart, basically. So it's quite a simple observation. And it's there's other good evidence for it, but that's the simplest bit. So it's not kind of some wild guess. It's pretty well established now, I think.
Mm. So all this go to the so-called theory of everything?
Well, that would be the hope. I mean, the theory of everything, I should say, is really, it would be a theory that explained all the forces of nature that we see and all the particles that we see in one package. Mm. And at the moment, we don't have that. And in particular, gravity, which is the most common force. You know, it's the first force that we thought we understood. You can go all the way back to Newton, 1680, for a good, theory of gravity. But that theory doesn't fit with the theories of the other forces of nature. And those are things like electricity and magnetism, which is also familiar. So that seemingly simple idea of bringing those concepts together into one unified whole has defeated physicists to this day. Einstein, yeah, spent the last 50 years of his life trying to do that, actually, and failed. And it's not surprising he failed, because, he died in 1955, and in the 50 years after he failed, we've still failed. So it's obviously a difficult problem. And actually what we need is some experimental evidence. I mean, science is, again, I'm sorry to use the word, but it's quite a simple process in a way. What you do is you look at nature and you you observe it carefully and you try and work out what's happening. And the problem with gravity is it's an incredibly weak force. It's something like a billion, 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 billion times weaker than electricity and magnetism, so electromagnetism, the force that sticks magnets onto your fridge door. So billions of times weaker than that. So it's very hard to observe it. You can only observe it at a big level, looking at planets going around stars. But if you try and observe it in a particle physics laboratory, it just doesn't make any... You know, the gravitational force of attraction of you, between you and your cup of coffee on your table, is small. Right? You don't go flying towards your cup of coffee. So that's the problem with it. And in the absence of evidence, we find it very difficult to just sit there with a pen and paper and work out exactly how it works.
And so you're looking for something that would bridge the gap between quantum mechanics and general relativity.
We would love to. I mean, that's kind of the holy grail, as it were. And honestly, whether the LHC gives us any signposts in that direction is open to debate. It's unlikely, I would say. I mean, the things we do know... There's this mass problem, and we certainly know that we're in the right region for that. There's a dark matter issue, and we're in the right region for that. But whether it gives us signposts to a unified theory is an open question. We just don't know.
But you're not anticipating having to throw the standard model out?
I think we probably are, actually, and we would hope that would be the case. I mean, the standard model is a... It's a bit of a mess in a way. I mean, I should say what it is. It's the theory of the other forces of nature. So the other three, excluding gravity and the particles. And it's been around since the 70s.
And the other three, what? They're the strong nuclear force, the weak nuclear force, and the electromagnetic
that's
force.
That's right. Yeah. So they're the forces that work, the strong forces in the world that work in the world of the small. And it's been around since the 70s. And actually, if you speak to some of the people who put it together, they would say that it was... They never expected it to be as successful as it has been. It's withstood every bit of experimental probing for the last 30 years. But it's very imperfect. I mean, it leaves a lot of things are put in by hand. The masses of the particles, for example.
What do you mean put in by hand?
Well, literally, it doesn't tell you what the mass of the electron is. You just write it down. You just measure it and then put it into the theory. Right. It doesn't tell you how strong... The forces should be, you just put them in. It does tell you how the strengths change as you go back to the start of the universe, but it doesn't tell you how strong they were. So there's a lot of... in some sense, there's an arbitrary bit to the standard model and there's a predictive bit. Mm. And what you would like, really, is a theory that says this is the way the universe has to be. Now, it maybe there isn't such a theory, of course, but it's not satisfactory in that sense. So what particle physicists have been doing for decades is to try and break it. And at least now we've got this machine, the LHC, which goes to the point where you either confirm it or break it. And that place is where this Higgs particle comes in. So if you find one Higgs particle, the so-called standard model Higgs, then you would complete the standard model. And if you found nothing else, then... You may be quite stuck, actually, as to where to go next. But if you find these supersymmetric particles, these neutralinos, these dark matter particles, you would then find five Higgs particles which in this theory, and that would not be the standard model. It would be beyond the standard model. So I think most physicists actually would expect us to find something beyond the standard model rather than just confirm it.
So where will it take us with regard to... I know that it's controversial. I don't know how you feel about string theory.
Well, string theory is a theory of gravity as well.
Yeah.
So string theory is a candidate for a theory of everything. The thing is that we'd have to be lucky, I think, to be able to make progress in that direction. One of the predictions of string theory is that there are extra dimensions in the universe, which
11
is a strange thing.
11 instead of 4, yeah?
Yeah, I mean, very hard to picture, but in fact it can be the case, and that we wouldn't have noticed if, let's say, light doesn't travel in those extra dimensions. So we see things with our eyes by detecting light. So if light doesn't go into the extra dimension, then you don't see the extra dimension. So it's that simple, really. If those extra dimensions are big enough and they're set up in the right way, then it could be that we see signatures of them at the LHC. But if we don't see signatures of them, it could be because they're too small or they're not set up in the right way. So if we're lucky, we'd see a signature and we'd be able to say, well, string theory's on the right track. But if we don't see any evidence, then string theory may still be on the right track. That's the problem with it. That's why some physicists say, well, it's not really science at the moment, it's mathematics, because, you know, the point about science is you can falsify it, and you can't falsify string theory at the moment.
No, well, but you can falsify mathematics by making up or having a very beautiful formula which actually doesn't bear any relationship to reality.
Well, exactly, and that could be what string theory is. I mean, the maths is right. They've not done the sums wrong, you know, but there's no reason that your bit of maths has to be the bit that nature describes nature.
What about, I don't want to go here really, but we'll try, loop quantum gravity, which seems to have superseded string theory?
Well, that's another theory that people like Lee Smolin, who's a very famous author, have pushed that theory. And again, these are all very complicated attempts to bring gravity into the fold. So they're complicated attempts to do a very simple thing. It should be simple, but it doesn't seem to be. So the problem is that because gravity is so weak, it means you have to go to very, very, very high energies to probe it on this level, right? So basically, what these extra dimensions can do is they can lower the energy at which you can see the effects of gravity in particle physics. That's essentially what they do. So the hope would be that these extra dimensions are set up in the right way so that the LHC has enough energy to go into this realm, this so-called quantum gravity realm. And then you could see whether loop quantum gravity or string theory or something else is the theory that describes what you see in the experiment. But if there aren't extra dimensions, then we will never build a particle accelerator big enough to probe those energies, because the galaxy is not a big enough particle accelerator to do that.
And science funding is limited.
Well, it's limited in that sense. Yeah, I don't think we'll ever build one 100 light years across, which is kind of the thing you'd need to do that. So then you have a problem. A theory of everything may then be beyond our reach. I mean, if you can't probe it by experiment, then you don't really make progress.
I was reading, I don't know whether this is the same thing really, but I was reading an article the other day that wondered whether we would ever see the end of science. In other words, we would go as far as we possibly could. We've got a 27-kilometer LHC, and, it's impossible to imagine that we could get anything bigger or better than that. This is it. We hit the brick wall. End of science. What do you think?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of science, so there's biology and chemistry as well. But I mean, in terms of fundamental physics, it could be. I mean, you don't just build these things for the sake of building them. You build them when you've got a specific problem that you can identify and you can see a way to observing something that helps you solve it. In this case, it's the origin of mass and those problems with the Standard Model. But I mean, it's not only the fact that you don't get funding for things. You can't just say, well, let's build a bigger one because it'd be nice and we all want to stay in our jobs. I mean, actually, I would have no interest in being in the field if there were no way that you could do experiments to go any further. So if the LHC gets to the point where we observe some things, we find the Standard Model Higgs, let's say, and nothing else, and we have no real idea what to do next, then we won't build another one. We'll go elsewhere. It may be that observing these cosmic ray collisions that hit the Earth with huge energies is the way to go, because that gives you access to these very large energies. Or you may have to go in a different direction, and these big particle colliders might have reached the end of their useful life. I don't know, but it could be that we discover this supersymmetric theory, we get loads of new particles, and we can see where we need to go next to understand nature. But that's what it is. It's not as some sort of industrial complex physics. I think it almost sounds idealistic, but I think it is idealistic. It's a pure subject where the people who do it just want to find out about nature. They don't just want to get more money to build a bigger toy.
The evidence of supersymmetry, which you would find if neutralinos would be there, that would lead you to more particles, because supersymmetry requires each Standard Model particle to have a partner to balance it, yeah?
That's right. It just doubles the number of particles. And
excellent.
It sounds kind of ridiculous. It's like, why is that a simplification? Hmm. But actually, there's a property of particles called spin. And there are two kinds of particles in nature. There's ones that have what we call half-integer spin, which is kind of a big word, but it's just electrons and quarks and the matter particles have that. And then there are things that have integer spin, which are the particles that carry forces. So the photon, the particle of light, the gluon that carries the strong nuclear force, those things have integer spin. So there's this difference between forces and matter particles. And what supersymmetry does is it doubles the number of particles, but it gives each half-integer spin guy an integer spin partner, and each integer spin guy a half-integer spin partner. So it kind of, it bridges that gap between force particles and matter particles. It kind of makes a symmetry between them. And it's actually quite natural, it turns out. It's, without getting too into big words and things, it's what's called a space-time symmetry. So it's... Einstein's theory of relativity is a theory of space and time, and that theory tells you in a way, or suggests that there should be this symmetry, because this spin property is actually a property of space and time, essentially. So it's a very natural thing, actually, for nature to have done. It seems like it would be an elegant thing, and it solves a lot of other problems, actually. It solves some problems in the Standard Model which are called fine-tuning problems, where you have to, as I said before, there are many arbitrary things in the Standard Model, like the masses of the particles, the strengths of the forces. And what supersymmetry does is it you don't have to fine-tune those things that you put in to get the theory to work. It makes the theory behave itself in a much more natural way. And it's not surprising, really, because it's a very fundamental property of nature, we think. So it's not random, this thing. It's not just let's double the number of particles, that'll be a laugh, you know. It's kind of well motivated, and the fact that it gives you these dark matter candidates actually was not it wasn't put into the theory wasn't invented to do that. It just happens that you do it for these other nice mathematical and aesthetic reasons, and it gives you a candidate for dark matter which the astronomers tell us is there. So that it's quite well motivated, quite nice.
Just going back to the Higgs boson, or the God particle, will you can't see it, you'll never be able to see it. How will you know if one exists, and is it like a needle in a haystack?
Well, it is like a needle in a haystack, yeah. And in fact, I have a German colleague who in a very German way calculated how many standard size needles it would be like in how many standard size haystacks, because they have those kind of things in Germany, and it's something like one needle in 12.5 standard haystacks, so it's very hard to find. But actually, you see it in the same way that you see, electrons in a way, or any of the particles. I mean, what the general rule in particle physics is, if you make something that's very heavy, and we expect the Higgs, if it exists, to be something like 120 to 170 times as heavy as a proton. So it's very heavy. It's heavy, it's a gold nucleus kind of weight, or more than that, actually. So they fall to bits. So heavy things fall to bits into lighter things. And what you do is you detect the debris of these particles. Now, there are a lot of particles that we found in that way. The top quark, which was discovered in the 90s in Chicago, which is the heaviest particle we've yet seen, actually heavier than the Higgs, almost certainly. That thing was seen by its debris. So you detect all the debris, and the trick is to patch it all back together. So you're basically looking for the thing that... You trace everything back to the thing that fell to bits, basically, and it's relatively easy to do that. Relatively. I mean, the problem is, it depends on what the Higgs decays into. Yeah. How easy it is to see.
And if you hang on a minute. If you don't know what it decays into, then how do you know that the bits are that you're looking at used to be a Higgs?
First of all, the Higgs theory specifies exactly what it should decay into. The thing is, though, that what it decays into depends on how heavy it is. Yeah. So, and we don't know how heavy it is. But, for example, the easy thing is if it's more than twice the mass of these things called W particles, which are actually involved in the weak nuclear force, then it's very easy to see, because it decays into two W particles, and we're good at detecting W particles, and we know how to do it. That's fine. If it's very light... So about 120 times the mass of the proton. It decays predominantly into things called B quarks, and they're tremendously difficult to see because of the there's a lot of other things that happen at the LHC that look like those. You produce B quarks all over the place. So then digging it out becomes more difficult. But the idea basically is you look for debris in the collisions, and you can tell if the debris comes from a single thing. And because you measure it all very precisely, you can tell how heavy that thing was. And so we know what we know. We know the particles that exist in the Standard Model. We've discovered them. So if you see event after event, so collision after collision, with decay products that lead you back to something that weighs, let's say, 120 times the mass of the proton, then you know it's something new. So you don't know what it is yet, but you know it's something new, yeah. And then you focus on and you try and measure its properties.
And will there be... You've got five detectors at the LHC, yeah?
Yeah.
Will there be teams of scientists at each detector kind of competing against each other to find as much as they can, or does each detector have a different role?
No, there are actually two of them, the two big ones, are just what we call general purpose detectors, and that's the one that I work on, ATLAS, and another one called CMS. And so their job is to really look for the Higgs and look for new physics, and they compete. But also, the reason you have two of them is that you want independent measurements. I mean, that's the way science works. And so the teams are supposed to stay separate, the designs are completely different, they're not supposed to talk to each other, and you won't believe that you've discovered something like the Higgs until both of them see it, basically, independently. The other three detectors are more specific. They have different roles, so they're looking for different kinds of physics. So that's basically the way it works. You need at least two that are going to be general purpose things, because you know if you see something very strange, then it could be that your detector isn't working. I mean, the one that I work on, ATLAS, is, you know, it's 20 meters high, 40 meters long, 100 million data channels, so 100 million pixels if you want. So it's very difficult to calibrate those things, and you know, you can see things that are artifacts of your detector rather than actual things that are occurring in nature. So that's the way that it works. That's why there's more than one.
Gorgeous. I mean, I can't even begin to imagine how you would sort all that out.
No, I mean, the thing is, this is one of the hardest things that humans do, which is one of the reasons why it's very exciting and very inspiring in a way. I mean, the fact that 85 countries can come together to do this, and you need them. You know, one country could not do this. The thing is, though, we've had a lot of practice. I mean, we've been doing particle physics, arguably, since the most famous New Zealand physicist, actually, in Manchester, Ernest Rutherford, discovered the atomic nucleus, just about 100 metres from where I'm sat now, actually. So that was, in a sense, the dawn of this journey into the centre of matter. And we've been doing it ever since, and we've been doing it with bigger machines. Rutherford did it on a bench. We have to do it in the 27 kilometres underneath Geneva. But it's the same. It's the same techniques. So we've developed them over a century.
I wonder what Rutherford or Einstein would have thought about the LHC.
Rutherford would have absolutely loved it, because it's, and Einstein would as well, because it's, the thing is, it's a simple process, really. It really is saying, if you want to find out how the universe works, you've got to look at the universe. And we've done the simple things, because no one's got any cleverer over the last few centuries. We've just got more technologically able. So these are the lengths you've got to go to now to go to the edge of our knowledge, and that's why you build it. So it's not random, and it's not let's build something as big as we can. It's let's build something that goes slightly beyond our knowledge, and let's look at the universe.
LHC then should create tiny black holes. This is what the people are worried about. No tiny black holes created.
It's almost... It's possible, and it would be exciting, because it would mean, at least, that there were extra dimensions in the universe. It's a prerequisite, right, to create the little black holes. You need the extra dimensions. And as I said before, we have no evidence at all that there are extra dimensions, other than it would be nice, and string theorists would be happy. But that's the only evidence we've got. So it's extremely unlikely anyway. If you do create them, then it would be wonderful, because you would see them in their decay products as they fall to bits, and you would have evidence for extra dimensions. So in a way, it would be the step to the Holy Grail, as I said before. It would be the most exciting thing you could do. But you will get nobody who would put a dollar on it, you know. It's very unlikely.
I read that if you do get tiny black holes, they'll evaporate almost instantly in a puff of energy called Hawking radiation. Which, well, yeah, consequently, if that happens, Dr. Stephen Hawking, after whom they have been named, the puffs of energy, will get the Nobel Prize for Physics.
I think he should, because, see, Hawking radiation is, it's probably the first step on the road to this quantum theory of gravity, in a way. What you need to do Hawking radiation is you need some quantum mechanics, which is the theory of subatomic particles, and you need gravity, which is the theory of black holes, general relativity, Einstein's theory. So it's one of the first steps into unifying them together. So it was probably Hawking's greatest contribution, I would say, to physics. It's what he's famous for in physics. And so, yeah, it would be a very well-deserved Nobel Prize if you saw those things. But as I mentioned, you need a whole lot of other stuff in the universe that is on the border of being, well, it's unlikely, shall we say, but it would be the most exciting thing we could do.
You sound as if you're trying to simultaneously talk it down and also present it as being very exciting. Like, you're obviously excited by it, but you don't want people to overestimate the discovery that may come out of it.
It's like, you know, if I was a cricket commentator, it's like you saying to me, will New Zealand win the next the next World Cup cricket? You know, I could say, well, yeah, it'd be great, wouldn't it? But I'm not sure whether it'll happen.
It's
in that sense, right? I mean, the thing is, it would be the best thing that could happen at the LHC. But if you ask me what's going to happen, I would say, well, I wouldn't put my money on that, because it requires a whole lot of other stuff. The thing you can say at the LHC is the origin of mass, right? We almost certainly, pretty much 100% sure, actually, that we'll discover the origin of mass in the universe, because we know where to look for that. If you say, are you going to discover extra dimensions, which is what you're actually saying when you say you're going to see a black hole, then I'm going to have to say, well, I don't know. I've got no way of gauging that, that we've got no evidence for them.
Just very briefly, there's been a big stoush in the UK because of so-called cuts to research funding. Mm. The science minister says, no, there aren't. And plenty of other people, including yourself and Professor Hawking, have said, yes, there are. Mm. And it was said to have the potential to affect experiments at the LHC. Is that the case?
Yes, I mean, there have been cuts. I think they were accidental, actually.
Right.
I think they were just basically... the government
bad
missed
bookkeeping,
it.
Yeah,
I think so. I think that it's a serious problem, because it's not just particle physics. I mean, you know, we know in the UK, and I suspect it's the same in New Zealand, that we need scientists and engineers, and most countries in the world are having difficulty attracting young people into science and engineering, and these people are the future of our economies. You know, science and engineering gave us the modern world, and so I think, if you send out negative signals as a government by either messing up or deliberately cutting science funding, and it's very small amounts of money, right, then you further discourage people from going into science and engineering, and you stack up a whole host of problems for the future. Because I can't think of... We couldn't run our societies, we couldn't have the modern world without people trying to push the boundaries of our knowledge. It's not a luxury, it's absolutely essential that we do that. I mean, one of my great heroes, Carl Sagan, when asked, why do we go into space, said, well, if the dinosaurs had a space program, they'd still be around, right? Which is funny, but it's true. You know, we live in this very challenging environment, and the environment is not just the Earth, it's the solar system, it's the universe is our environment. Over two-thirds of species have been wiped out by asteroid impact, ever lived on the Earth. So our environment is wide and difficult to understand and challenging, and without this quest for knowledge and the quest to understand the world that we live in, we're in real deep trouble. So I think it needs to be set in that context, and it's easy for politicians to get to not understand that, to not understand really what it is that we're doing here. Science is the quest for understanding the universe, and that's important.